Meeting Patrick all those years ago had been unexpected, and even more surprising to Jess when he asked her to marry him. She had thought herself unlovable, too much of a mess, too broken. He had been warm, funny, loving, and tolerant of her problems. He had just wanted her to feel better, to be normal. But now he's gone, and her home has been destroyed. Jess opens the car door and stands in the freezing cold. She knows there can't be anything left, but part of her wants to go inside. Most of the windows on the front are shattered. There are teetering piles of debris in the front garden, more littered around the house, obviously placed there by the people investigating the arson. She can see a large yellow and white sticker plastered to the front door, telling people to keep away. "Active crime scene," it says. Is this what it's reduced to? The first house she bought with Patrick. The horrendous 70s decor disaster lovingly renovated into their home. The place they brought their newborn daughter to. Where she cried through the night. Where she took her first steps. Jess angrily wipes away the tears blurring her vision. There's no use standing here now. She climbs back into the car, preparing to drive away, when she sees another car pull up, directly outside her house. It's an old-style grey Land Rover, and the driver gets out and leans against the door. A sudden flame casts his face in a flickering glow as he bends down to light a cigarette. Jess can just make out dark hair, stubble. It's the man from the hospital, Griffin. First there, now here. It's no coincidence. He's definitely interested in what happened to her. But why? She remembers his conversation behind the curtain. He didn't think she was responsible. She wonders what makes him so sure when the other detective was ready to arrest her. He finishes his cigarette and drops it on the road. He climbs back into the Land Rover and Jess starts the engine of Nav's car. She hears the roar of the old truck, then follows him as he pulls away. He drives slowly at first through the residential streets, then speeds up as if realizing she's behind him. His car is quicker than Nav's shitty 1.2 Clio, but she knows the streets around here well. After about 20 minutes of quick left and rights, he pulls into an industrial estate and she follows him in. She doesn't want to let him go. The back of her mind registers the potential danger, but this is the only thing she can think to do right now. This man knows something. His car slows. There are a few streetlights here. The buildings are large and intimidating. The Land Rover turns into an alleyway behind a huge unit and stops, and she pulls up behind him. The car door opens and he climbs out, looking at her. Her heart jumps, but he walks past, then heaves a large recycling bin behind the Clio. She turns in her seat, frantically realizing the enormity of the situation she's got herself in. She's trapped. The car is pinned between the bin and his Land Rover. She thinks about getting out and running, but she knows she won't get far, not feeling like this. Her hand hovers over the gear lever. She could reverse quickly, put all the power of this little car into the bin and hopefully it would move. She could try, at least. But something stops her. He casually walks up to her driver's side window and knocks on it, twice. The Clio's doors are locked. He can't get in. And she stares at him for a second, her wide eyes meeting his. He gestures for her to lower the window. She presses it down a fraction.
"What the hell are you doing out of the hospital?"
he growls. "What the hell were you doing at my house?" she replies, forcing her voice to sound more confident than she is feeling. It starts to rain again. Large droplets fall in the glow of the headlights, scattering across the windscreen. He squints upwards as it settles in his hair. He gestures to the passenger side, pulling the collar of his coat up.
"Let me in,"
he says. He sees her reluctance.
"For fuck's sake, I'm not going to do anything to you. Just open the door. I'm getting cold."
Jess takes a deep breath in. She knows this isn't a good idea, but what has she got to lose? Her husband and her home have gone. The police are almost certainly now looking for her. She's not allowed to see her daughter. In terms of risky behaviour, this is no more than the next in a long line of shitty decisions. She clicks the lock off and he walks around to the passenger side, pulling it open. He gets in. He smells of wet dog and cigarette smoke. He shakes his head.
They can't possibly have let you out.
They were going to arrest me.
So you're running from the police?
He snorts with derision.
Sensible?
He adds sarcastically. I don't trust them. And who are you? She demands. Don't say you're a cop, because I know you're not.
I am a detective, just not at the moment, he says.
She sees his jaw clench. He goes to say something to her, but his phone rings in his pocket, interrupting him. He pulls it out and glares at her before answering. Griffin talks in grunts and single syllables. Jess can't hear the other side of the call.
I'll be there,
he says finally, then turns to her.
You need to stop following me.
Tell me why you're so interested in what happened and I'll leave you alone.
I have to go.
So I'll come with you, she replies. He stays silent, so she carries on. You seem to be the only person who doesn't think I killed my husband, and I want to know why. Even though he's police, or was, something about him feels different to the cops she's encountered in the past. Back at the hospital, he listened. He believed her, stood up for her against the woman detective. And he doesn't look like a cop. That helps somehow. He pulls a packet of cigarettes out of his jacket pocket and lights one. He doesn't ask permission. Jess worries about Nav's car and the smell, then dismisses it. He's going to be angrier about a lot more, after all. Griffin's eyes stay downwards, his brow furrowed as he smokes. Then he swears under his breath and sighs.
Fine, but you need to leave this car. They'll be looking for you and it won't take them long to work out what you're driving.
He notices her hesitation.
Look, that's my offer, take it or leave it. If I was going to do something to you, I would have done it by now.
He gestures around the alleyway.
There are no cameras here and it's not like you could have defended yourself. Look at the size of you. I could have strangled you within seconds.
He's right. He's a huge bloke with meaty hands and muscular shoulders. She wouldn't stand a chance. She's not sure whether to feel reassured or scared by the fact he'd already worked out the method for her murder. But she turns off the engine. He climbs out, discarding his cigarette butt on the concrete and walking back to his car. She follows him, and he leans across and pushes the passenger door open.
Get in.
She climbs inside and fastens her seatbelt. Where are we going? She asks. He shakes his head.
Stop asking so many questions. You'll see soon enough.
The Land Rover splutters into life, and he pulls out of the alleyway. Chapter 8. He had wanted to see it for himself. There's no substitution for being at the scene of a crime. Griffin had stood, looking at the burned-down house, at the crumbling walls, at the smashed glass, and thought, "Were you here?" If he'd been there 24 hours earlier, would he have seen him? Would he now know? But a fire is different. He'd scowled, smoking his cigarette down to the butt, then discarding it on the ground. Even after all this time, his thoughts felt scrambled. He needs to get some rest. To stop thinking about this all the time. And now she's here. Somehow she's got out of the hospital. Somehow, despite a head lack and a possible concussion, she's driving around as night falls and is now sitting in the passenger seat of his Land Rover. He should call Taylor. He should take her back to the hospital at the very least. But fuck, he can't stand D.S. Taylor. Never has. She hangs on to investigations like a fetid limpet, never fluctuating from the obvious suspect. She's so far in the box, she's almost 6 feet under. And this woman? Jessica Ambrose. He recognizes the look in her eyes. That confusion, grief, fear, mixed with dogged determination. He remembers how that felt, and how much in the beginning he had needed someone just to stay with him. A quiet presence to stave away the sinking loneliness. The isolation he still feels. He's been by himself for so long. But as desperate as he is to talk, to her, to someone, to anyone who will listen, he says nothing. Just lights another cigarette and focuses on the road ahead.
Children's Services Report, Home Visit. Name of child, Robert Daniel Keane. Date of birth, the 31st of March, 1986. Age 9. Siblings? None. Date, 25th of January, 1996. Reason for referral, continual absence from school. Concerns around well-being of child, flagged by class teacher. On arrival at the family home on Millmore Way, I was introduced to Gary Keane, father, and Marcus Keane, uncle, living with the family. The house presented as poorly maintained and dirty. There was evidence of alcohol consumption, empty bottles, and suspected drug use, smell of marijuana, throughout the property. I asked after Robert's mother. Father said she left in February 1990, when Robert was 3. Neither Robert nor Gary Keane have seen her since. Robert stayed outside in the hallway while we spoke. We discussed the reason for my visit and Robert's continued absence from school. Father stated that Robert has been bullied by other children and suffers anxiety as a result. He mentioned homeschooling, although was unable to expand on this or provide any evidence to this effect. His father described Robert as generally healthy, sleeping and eating well, although previous health checks at school confirm Robert is underweight, in the second centile against his age and height. He has a scar on his left forehead, in his hairline. Father refused permission for access to Robert's medical records. On viewing Robert's bedroom, I asked about the lack of sheets on Robert's bed. Father explained they're in the wash, due to some problems with bed wetting. I asked for time alone with Robert, which was granted with initial hesitation from his father. Robert has few toys, with the exception of two large battered hardback books, which he showed me after encouragement. One is James and the Giant Peach, the other a complicated medical dictionary. I believe these to be library books, although was unable to confirm. I asked if he could understand the dictionary. He said he didn't, but he liked the pictures. School have stated that Robert is an intelligent child with a reading age beyond his years. He is quiet and shy, but started to open up as our conversation progressed. He refused to answer when I asked if he had any friends, and doesn't seem to have any other adults or female influences in his life. Throughout our discussion, he was holding a notebook, bound with an elastic band. He refused to let me see inside, and when I pushed, he shouted no and said, "It's mine, you're not allowed to look at my stuff." At the end of the allotted hour for the visit, the father interrupted our conversation, stating, "You need to leave now, we have to go out." Recommendations. The home environment is clearly below standards of cleanliness and hygiene, and both caregivers smoke, with regular use of expletives in their language. Because of this, and Robert's low body weight, I believe he is unlikely to achieve a reasonable standard of health without provision of services from the local authority. I would therefore like to refer Robert's case for an inter-agency review, with the potential of further specialist assessments from representatives from Hampshire Constabulary and the Early Help Team. In addition, an application for a court order for access to Robert's medical records is recommended and may shed further light. Referral to educational psychologist to be made. conversation needed with head teacher to explore allegations of bullying, with main priority to get Robert back to school as soon as possible. Child to remain with family while investigations continue.
Chapter 9. They drive in the rusty Land Rover in silence. Every now and again, Jess glances Griffin's way, willing him to speak, but she doesn't dare open her mouth. After about a quarter of an hour of driving, he meets her eye.
"Stop staring at me," he growls.
"Tell me why you believe me. The detective at the hospital said you think something's connected." He looks her way sharply.
"You heard that?"
"Tell me." Griffin hesitates, then takes a turning off the road. He pulls down a darkened track and stops the car. He switches off the engine. Jess looks out of the window, and in the silence she suddenly realizes how isolated she is, how stupid she's been. Griffin leans towards her and her hand flies to the door handle to escape, but he reaches down into the footwell and pulls up a black rucksack. She's breathing heavily, and he notices what she was about to do. He gives her a disparaging look.
"For fuck's sake," he mutters.
He pauses.
"You squeamish?"
Jess glances at the bag. What could he have in there? A dead animal? Chopped off fingers? "I don't know," she says nervously. He scowls at her for a moment, then opens the top of the rucksack.
"This all started about 2 years ago," he says.
He pulls a scrappy cardboard file out of the bag, resting it on his lap and opening it. With his other hand, he turns on the overhead light.
"I was called out to a crime scene of a woman, strangled and raped, obviously been tied up and tortured before she was killed."
He shifts through a pile of what Jess recognises as crime scene photographs and hands her one. She gasps. In the harsh light, she can see pale skin, dark bruises, a face, eyes closed.
"She was 21. A waitress at a local cafe. Her name was Lisa Kershaw."
Jess looks again. The body is naked.
Ligature marks clear on her neck, wrists and ankles.
"So you are a detective?" she asks.
"I was," he says gruffly.
He quickly moves on.
"Then two more bodies were found."
He hands her the photos. Two more women. Naked. Dead. Jess cringes at the images.
"Daria Capshaw and Sarah Jackman, strangled, tortured and raped."
He talks with the manner of a man getting something off his chest.
Words that haven't been spoken for a long time, released in a flurry.
He turns and looks at her.
"So that's three. We have a serial killer."
"I didn't hear about any of this on the news," Jess says, stunned. "How come?"
"My chief was worried about the publicity encouraging the killer, so we kept it quiet. But then more major crimes came in. Two rapes, home invasions, lengthy and brutal. At first we didn't think there was a connection."
"And there was?" Griffin nods.
"The victims had heard someone on their properties before the attacks. Footprints were found in the flower beds, a star-shaped pattern traced back to an old-style Adidas running shoe also found near the body of Sarah Jackman. But it was odd. Killers don't usually devolve. They start with rape, then move on to murder as they get confident. They don't go backwards. So we wondered whether there had been more murders we hadn't noticed."
Jess sits forward in her seat. It seems dreamlike, Griffin's recounting of death and violence. But how could these possibly be linked to her? He turns over to the next photograph and Griffin points, his face grim.
"Two more. Same MO as the first. Raped and strangled."
Grainy, dark photos. Bodies hard to make out.
"Happened a few years before, but in two different counties, so nobody joined the dots. Unsolved."
"And then what?"
"We linked up, started a task force. But we found nothing, and it went quiet. Until these two.
He points again.
Emily Johnson and Isabel Richards, he says. Both sex workers. Hit over the head with what the pathologist believed to be a hammer, then stabbed to death.
It's different, she says.
It is. But that's a lot of violent unsolved murders for England, especially when you consider most homicides are committed by someone known to the victim.
He looks at her, thinking. She's started to shiver in the cold car and wraps her arms around herself, but he doesn't seem to notice.
Then, a year ago, there's another home invasion, he continues slowly. A couple. They're threatened with a handgun, torch shone in their faces. They're separated, tied up. The woman raped repeatedly. For hours.
Griffin's voice is low. He's talking slowly, his words measured.
The husband is beaten severely and knocked out with a log from the woodpile. When he wakes up, his wife is dead, bludgeoned to death in the same way, her hands bound with cord from the curtains.
Griffin goes silent for a second and Jess can see his jaw muscles working, obviously trying hard to get a grip on himself. She can tell these unsolved murders have taken a toll on him.
If we'd caught the guy before...
Griffin stops again, and Jess can only imagine the guilt he must have felt, knowing someone else had died on his watch. Griffin takes a deep breath, then looks over at her.
But then the trail goes cold.
Nothing since then? Jess asks in disbelief. Nothing for a year? Griffin shakes his head.
Nothing until I got a call last night, one dead in a house fire. Suspected arson. Suspected murder.
A knot forms in her stomach. That's her house. Her husband. She starts to feel sick. Jess knows she didn't start the fire, but she'd assumed it was some random. A teenager on a dare that went wrong. A revenge attack in a case of mistaken identity. She didn't think it could be as widespread as this.
It can't possibly be linked, she stutters.
He pulls his phone out of his jacket pocket, thumbs scrolling, then shows her an image. She shies away, but this time it's innocuous. An earring, a crescent moon, flashes of green and blue in the silver.
That yours?
She shakes her head.
You sure?
Jess looks again. Yes. She pauses. She hardly dares to ask.
It was found just inside your front door.
Jess opens and closes her mouth. Griffin looks at her.
It belonged to the last rape victim. I believe it was placed there deliberately.
But why?
That I don't know.
He reaches forward and starts the engine again, and she realizes what the phone call was about. There's been another one, she asks. We're going to a murder scene.
Me, not you. You're staying in the car.
And without waiting for agreement, he guns the engine and they're back on the road. Motorway turns into dual carriageway, then into a town. Jess still has the photographs in her hands and she goes through them again as they drive. Flickering images in the streetlights. Death, destruction, murder. What could this possibly have to do with her? Fear takes hold and she quietly starts to cry again. Who wanted her family dead? There's nothing exceptional about the three of them that might mark them out as a target. Patrick's job is dull and desk-bound, and she's no more than a housewife. She feels disorientated. She's read more books, watched more TV about this stuff than she can count. Documentaries, forensic psychology, the strange and macabre. But right now, it's not helping. Everything she's heard from Griffin could be torn straight out of the pages of one of those true crime accounts. And her head is a problem. If she moves too quickly, she still feels dizzy. It's obvious there's something not right in there.
but she can't worry about that now. Less than 24 hours ago, she was at home with her daughter and her husband. And now she's cold and wet in a grubby Land Rover with someone she knows nothing about, driving towards another murder. She's never seen a dead body, not in real life. But she's doggedly hanging on to this man as if he holds the solution to the hell that has become her existence. They drive for about an hour until Griffin pulls up in a suburban street. It's a nice area. Big faux Art Deco houses with gates and Discoveries and Evokes in their sprawling driveways. Jess looks at him. He's squinting out of the windscreen, obviously searching for someone. He opens his car door as a man walks down the road towards them. He's older, with a bald head, a round tummy, and a hangdog expression. Griffin glances back to Jess.
You stay here.
He sees her about to reply.
No argument. Stay here.
He climbs out of the car and stands with the man, who glares at Griffin. They're close enough that Jess can still hear their conversation.
This has got to stop, the man says. You can't hold one mistake over me forever. When this is over, Alan, I'll stop.
The man looks at Jess through the windscreen of the Land Rover.
She's staying here,
Griffin reiterates, as much for her benefit as for the man's. They start walking quickly down the road. Jess watches them go for a moment, then opens the door and follows them. Sod Griffin. She needs to see this, to know it's all for real. This is her life, her nightmare. She pauses behind a parked car as Griffin and the man stop by a large white van. In the distance, she can see blue and white tape fluttering in the darkness.
What do we have?
She hears Griffin ask. Alan reaches into the back of the van and hands him something white. Jess watches Griffin as he puts on the crime scene suit, then the two men move away. She waits until they're a good distance, then grabs one herself. It's huge, soft and plasticky, and she does her best pulling the white overshoes on her trainers, blue gloves on her hands.
It's a massacre, she hears Alan say as she creeps behind them. Blood everywhere. You think it's him?
Griffin asks, and Alan nods.
Not seen anything like this for a long time. We're still waiting for the pathologist, but it's definitely murder. Major crimes have been and gone. Didn't say much.
Jess watches as they put on the face masks, then the hoods over their heads. She does the same. With this outfit on, Jess suddenly feels safe, indistinguishable from the other people teeming around in the road. They shuffle towards the house and stop at the police cordon. The scene guard watches as Alan bends down and writes in a turquoise logbook, then gestures behind to Griffin. He's already signed in, Jess hears him mutter as they both pass through. Jess waits. She's debating trying a false name, hoping the guard won't check ID, when a large crowd of SOCOs comes up behind her, talking loudly in their identical white suits. She integrates herself into the middle of the homogenous group as they joke with the scene guard, taking turns to sign the book. And then he waves them through, and she's in. It's a mansion with a long drive leading up to a grand entrance. Jess can see the glow from the open front door, and scene of crime officers move in and out of the area. The ground is littered with small yellow triangles. Every now and again she sees the flash from a camera. In the darkness, it's eerie, and Jess feels a shiver run down her back. To their left, a car is parked, driver's side door open, people leaning inside. She catches up quickly to Griffin, just as Alan points to the car.
The first one's in there. 18-year-old boy. Shot. Quite a few times, at what seems to be point-blank range. And slashed with a knife. We're not sure of the specifics yet.
Jess can't look away, imagining what might be inside. But then she feels a tight hand on her arm. She looks up into Griffin's furious glare.
What the fuck? I told you to stay in the car.
I'm coming, I'm a part of this.
You know what?
I know. He stares at her, takes in her defiant expression behind the mask. Fine, he snaps, even though it's obvious to Jess it's not. But she knows he can't afford for her to make a scene, to draw attention to the fact that neither of them is supposed to be there. They've stopped at the entrance to a large white tent, to the right of the house. Alan's been watching their exchange and now glowers at them both.
She wasn't part of the deal,
he hisses to Griffin.
The deal is exactly what I say it is.
Griffin stands over him, clearly the bigger and stronger man.
You fucked up, and if it wasn't for that...
He shakes his head.
Just do what I ask, and once this is over, you'll never have to see me again.
Alan meets Griffin's stare for a moment, then drops his gaze, backing down. He wearily holds the tent flap open and Griffin ducks inside. As Jess goes past Alan, Griffin grabs her arm again.
Are you sure you want to see this?
Griffin asks, and she nods. But nothing could have prepared her for what's inside. A body, a woman, Jess realises, is lying on the ground. Floodlights have been set up and light the woman's face in a grimace. Everywhere Jess looks, there's blood. The woman's white nightgown is ripped and soaked in it. The grass around is stained red. Jess feels dizzy and realises she hasn't been breathing. She forces herself to take in small gasps of air.
We haven't touched the body, obviously, Alan whispers. But it's a good guess cause of death is from penetration wounds, probably from a knife. At first look, I would estimate she's been stabbed at least 30 times. That's a pretty chaotic attack,
Griffin mutters, and Alan nods.
And that's not all.
There's a second body behind. His face is mutilated beyond recognition, but from his hair and clothes, Jess assumes it's a man.
Multiple blunt force trauma to the head, plus what we think are more stab wounds but could be a shooting. We had reports of gunfire,
he mutters.
Looks like he was trying to run. Poor sod.
They don't stop. Alan leads them back out into the darkness. He points towards the house. They walk up the large stone steps. They go inside. It's an incredible place. Jess's eyes slowly adapt to the brightness and she takes in the sweeping staircase, the stone floors, photographs of a smiling couple on the wall. The stepping plates slide on the marble as they walk across them. The floor is covered with smears and smudges of blood and mud. Alan points to it as they walk.
Mess from first responders, he mutters. We won't get any usable footwear marks from that.
The hallway leads to double wooden doors left ajar. Alan pushes them open with a gloved finger and Jess stops in her tracks. The living room is a double height extension, rain starting to tap on the skylights in the roof. Jess can see it would have been tasteful, understated, minimally decorated in beiges and creams. But right now the room is utter chaos. The coffee table has been tipped over, the sofa pushed to one side, every other item of furniture in disarray. And every surface is covered in blood. Spatter runs down the walls. The cream chairs are smeared and streaked. A large pool has settled in the middle of the room where the bodies slump. The smell is alien and disturbing. Ferrous and metal, it sticks to the inside of Jess's nose. Even with the mask, she can almost taste it and she gags, putting her hand over her mouth. There are two bodies. A space has been cleared in the centre of the room and they rest against each other, wet and bloody. Jess can see a white rope has been slung over one of the ceiling beams above them, then wrapped around their necks. The man's hands are tied.
Have they? Were they?
Jess begins, pointing to the rope, but Alan shakes his head.
We found them like this. And there are none of the obvious ligature marks around their neck that you'd expect if they'd been hung.
It looks like a woman and a man. It looks like... Jess takes a step forward to look more closely. Griffin puts his arm out to stop her.
She starts. She can barely bring herself to say it. He nods slowly, his eyes narrow. The woman's hands are tied behind her back, her body coated in blood. She slumped forward awkwardly, but Jess can just make out the curve of her stomach. She had been pregnant. Jess feels nauseous. She feels her hot breath inside the crime scene mask. The blood, the frenzied nature of the attack is one thing, but to tie up and murder a pregnant woman. It was barbaric. Insane. She remembers how she felt when she was pregnant with Alice. She would have done anything to protect her unborn child. She wonders what went through this woman's mind. Whether she begged, whether she pleaded for her baby's life. Jess chokes back tears and starts to back away from the bodies.
Could have been worse,
Alan says, and Jess looks to him quickly. How, she thinks, how exactly could this be worse? Alan carries on.
There were due to be two others here yesterday evening, but they changed their minds at the last minute. They came around to apologise this afternoon and found the bodies on the lawn, and a kid, about 19, staying in their granny annex at the back.
A witness?
Griffin asks, but Alan shakes his head.
High as a kite. Slept in. Says he didn't hear a thing.
What's with the flag?
A large American flag has been draped over the sofa just behind the dead woman. It's bright and gaudy. To Jess it seems deliberately placed. Its edges are straight and precise. It's the only thing in the room not covered in blood. Alan looks at it.
We don't know for sure. We have a few theories.
But before they can ask, they hear a commotion behind them. People move aside as another figure enters the room. He looks the same as everyone else, but he obviously has authority over the scene. Griffin pulls Jess backwards.
Has anyone touched them?
The man shouts.
No one, no,
Alan replies. The man nods with satisfaction and crouches next to the corpses. His shoulders slump when he sees the woman. Jess hears him mutter a string of profanities. Griffin taps her on the shoulder and gestures for them to move away. She follows him back through the house. Once they are outside the living room, she feels a pull on her hand and Alan stops her. He watches Griffin as he walks out of the house, then turns to Jess.
Listen, he says. I don't know who you are or what you're doing here, but I'm telling you now, don't let him drag you into this mission of his. Nate's so deep he doesn't know where the surface is anymore. I'm going down with him and that's as much my fault as it's his, but you seem new to this. Don't let him take away everything you have.
Jess frowns. It's pretty much gone already, she replies and walks away. She sees nothing but blood as she walks out of the house. Handprints, smears and smudges. A photographer is capturing evidence on the wall outside the front door and it catches her eye. Something is written there. Bright red daubs in what she can only assume is blood. Jess stops and stares at the word. Pig, it says. Chapter 10. Jess catches up with Griffin at the Land Rover. He angrily pulls off the crime scene clothes, ripping them in the process and rolling them into a ball. He throws them into the back of the car, then climbs into the driver's side. She does the same and sits next to him, sighing with relief as she closes her eyes for a second. She's feeling dizzy again. The added exercise will not have done her head any good. Griffin starts the engine and they drive in silence. He doesn't look her way. His displeasure towards her is clear. Her head is spinning with everything she has seen. The murders seem insane. The sheer amount of blood, the stabbings, the flag. She doesn't understand how this could possibly be linked to her, to setting fire to her house. Patrick's murder is nothing like what she saw today. Thoughts buzz in her head.
She sees the blood. The pregnant woman. She thought murderers had a type. One way of killing. Why would someone set fire to a house one day, then kill 5 people in their home with knives and rope and guns? Griffin's revving the engine hard, charging into every corner. She glances across at the speedometer. It says 60, then 70 miles an hour. She hangs on to the car as she's thrown this way and that. He's taking out his anger on the road, and she can't blame him. She has no idea where they're going, until they stop outside a second-hand car garage. It's one of those locally owned places with crappy Ford Fiestas and 10-year-old Vauxhalls on the lot. Griffin doesn't wait for her as he slams out of the car, opening a large side door to the garage and stomping down steep metal stairs to the flat below. She hurries behind him, but before she gets inside the door, she can hear the noise. It's the bang of something thrown, then a crash. She tentatively opens the door. The place is no more than one large room and what she assumes to be a bathroom behind the door on the left. It has bare brick walls and wooden floors, and there are rugs and a sofa. A basic kitchen takes up the space on the far wall, with a double bed to the right of it. A large set of dumbbells are stacked in a corner. Griffin has overturned one of the chairs. A beer bottle is smashed against the wall next to her, splinters of glass across the floor, liquid running down the bricks. He roars and pummels his fists against the wall, then thumps one into the brickwork. He shouts, and she runs up to him, hanging onto his arm to stop him doing it again. He turns suddenly, his fist raised, directly in line with her head. She feels the tension in his muscles, the strength in his arms. It's all she can do not to be thrown to the floor as she hangs on. His face is twisted with anger. He looks at her. There is nothing in his eyes. No recognition, no humanity, just rage. He moves, forcing her against the wall, backed into a corner. With his other hand, he grabs her wrist. She feels his fingers dig into her flesh and she lets go of his arm. Her body floods with adrenaline, but it's not fear this time. It's something else. A wave of energy. She's angry, like him. He snatches her other wrist and holds her arms either side of her head. She feels the rough brickwork against her skin. She pushes against him as hard as she can to get away, but he holds her still, his face barely inches from hers. She's breathing heavily. She can feel her heart racing. She looks into his eyes, but all she can see in her head is the blood. The holes in their bodies, the flood of red. That unborn baby. The unborn baby. And then her mouth is hard against his. There's no elegance here, just bumped teeth, his stubble against her chin, her tongue in his mouth. He returns the kiss, pushing his hands into her clothes. They're cold against her warm skin, and she does the same to him, reaching under his shirt. His body is solid, rough, and she wants him to help her feel something, anything, to take the thoughts out of her head. She kicks her shoes off. She feels his hands push down into her trousers. His teeth knock against her lip and for a moment she tastes blood. It reminds her of the bodies. The red. But she pushes her eyes tightly closed and focuses on what he's doing. One hand down the back of her trousers. The other. She takes a quick breath in. Oh God. She pushes herself up against him. And she can feel his mouth on her neck, on her collarbone. She pulls his shirt off, then struggles with his belt and his jeans, his fingers still inside her, playing, distracting. But then, abruptly, he stops. He pulls away, his eyes meeting hers. Something's changed. He shakes his head, still out of breath, taking a step backwards.
No, we can't do this, he mutters,
almost to the floor. He turns away, pulling his jeans up, then picks up his shirt and the packet of cigarettes from the table and walks out of the flat. She watches the door close. She stands there against the wall, stunned. She liked it. She wanted it. To feel something other than the bottomless detachment. But something stopped him. She pulls her trousers up again before collapsing on the bed. She stares at the ceiling. She thinks she should feel guilty. Anything for what she tried to do so soon after Patrick's death. But she feels nothing except the sting of his rejection. I'm that much of a shitty person, she thinks. That's why he wouldn't fuck me. Not even a man like Griffin wants me. The door opens and Griffin comes back into the room with a sweep of cold air. He looks at her.
Jessica,
he begins, but she cuts him off. It's Jess, and I don't want to talk about it, she says, and he nods.
Suits me.
He joins her on the bed, taking his shirt off over his head and lying on his front, facing away from her. He pulls the duvet over himself. A flash of light reflects on his left hand, and for the first time Jess notices the wedding ring. So is that why he stopped them? But then why is he living here? She can't think about that now. Exhaustion hits her and she rests her head on the pillow. Despite his rebuff, he doesn't seem to mind her being in the bed next to him. And she's glad. Griffin? She asks, and he grunts. What's your name? He turns to face her, frowning.
What do you mean?
That man called you Nate. He turns away again.
Nate. Nathaniel Griffin, he says,
his voice muffled by the pillow.
Not many people call me that anymore. Just stick with Griffin.
Jess listens to his breathing. It's slowed now to a soft in and out. She closes her eyes. Images flash in her mind. The blood. The dead pregnant woman. Her ruined house. Think of something else, she thinks, screwing her eyes tightly shut. Something good. Alice. The ache of being apart from her daughter makes it almost hard for her to breathe. But Alice is alive. She's safe, Jess tells herself, with my mum and dad and Nav. And with thoughts of her daughter in her head, lying next to a strange man in a strange flat, she slowly falls into a deep, dreamless sleep.
Chapter 11. He likes the thump-thump of the bass line, so loud it reverberates on his diaphragm. The flash of the lights, the haze from the shots hastily downed at the bar. He dances, his hands above his head, the smell of sweat. From him and the other men in the club. He closes his eyes for a moment, feeling their bodies against his. Smooth skin, hard muscles. He feels a hand on his arm, gentle, caressing. Not seen you here before, the man shouts over the music. He meets his eyes. He sees his interest. My first time, he replies. Really? The man smiles suggestively. You want to do something about that? He looks at him. He looks young, barely out of his teens, but his confidence is attractive. This club is clearly somewhere he feels at home in his tight white t-shirt, arse-hugging jeans. He nods and the man smiles, then grabs his hand and starts pulling him from the dance floor towards the toilets. He pulls back and the man turns, looking at him curiously. Not here, he shouts. Let's get a taxi. Go back to mine. The man tilts his head to one side in a mock sulk. Then he grins. You better have something to make it worth my while. I'm sure I can knock up a rum and coke, he replies with a small smile. What's your name? Steve, he replies. What's yours? but he's already turned, the man following obediently after him, the name fixed in his head. Stephen, he thinks. Perfect. Perfect.
Day 3. Wednesday. Chapter 12. Jess wakes as daylight pushes its way into the room. For a moment she's disorientated, but then she realizes where she is and turns towards him. Griffin's still lying on his front, facing away from her. The duvet has been pushed off in the night, and she looks at him in the dim glow, taking in the muscles of his shoulders, the dips in his back. She can just see a collection of silvery pinkish lines running across the bottom of his spine, disappearing into his jeans. They seem to be newish scars, and she wonders how he got them. She thinks of her own arms and legs, of the white puckered lines crisscrossing her skin, some parallel to each other, some old, some new. They're a mess. She knows Griffin must have seen them by now, but he hasn't commented. And what on earth is this place? She frowns and gets out of bed. It's colder this morning, and she grabs the first thing close to her and puts on Griffin's sweatshirt. It smells of cigarettes and his skin. It conjures up a memory of last night, and something stirs in her. But she knows what happened, or rather what didn't happen, wasn't an act of romance. Just a release of stress and anger, no more than that. She pushes it out of her mind. There's a long wooden table in the centre of the room, and she wraps her arms around herself and walks over. Paper litters the surface, and she reads a few of the newspaper articles. They're all reporting homicides. Some have lines highlighted, others with comments scribbled in the margins. Some of the documentation seems to be printouts from a computer system or some sort of database. Dates, names, descriptions. But it's the wall to the left of the door that demands her attention the most. It's huge. Every inch of it covered in photographs and articles, seemingly pinned up randomly. A whiteboard is in the centre with a scrawl in almost illegible black marker pen. She stands in front of it. She looks more closely at the photos. Some of them are of places and people, smiling faces. But the others are photos of the dead. Some she saw last night, some new. Broken bodies, distorted and grey. Parts missing, eyes open, staring blindly into nothing. Blood, flesh torn, ripped skin. Jess's stomach turns over, but she can't look away, gripped by the horror on display. Then she remembers the bodies, the pregnant belly, the child now motionless inside, the blood. Before she can stop herself, images flicker through her mind. So much blood, everywhere, splattering the floor, the walls. She remembers the writing by the front door, crudely daubed in red. Pig. She stops. It's strangely specific. Was it a message to the police? Or a note to someone else? An estranged lover, maybe? She frowns and stares at the whiteboard. Something about the nature of the recent murders niggles in her brain. Something she's seen before. 5 people dead, one of them heavily pregnant, and Pig daubed next to the wall in blood. She takes a quick breath in. Griffin, she shouts without looking away from the board. He stirs in the bed, squinting at her with bleary eyes. She starts moving the photos about on the wall, pulling some off and dropping them to the floor. Her destruction moves him out of bed and he stands up, putting a t-shirt on and joining her. He watches as she continues, her movements quick. What are you doing? He asks. She gestures to a photo on the table. Pass me that one, and those two there. He does, and she sticks them back on the wall together. After a moment, she stops and takes a pace backwards, looking at it from afar. She points at the wall, then turns to Griffin. His face is still wrinkled from sleep, and she notices every time he moves, he winces.
"What are you seeing?"
he asks. She points at the group at the top, their names scrawled in black marker. "Lisa Kershaw, Daria Capshaw, and Sarah Jackman. All strangled, tortured, and raped." Griffin nods. He pulls a packet of capsules out of his bag and pushes one out of the foil, then stops and takes out a second. She watches as he throws the pills into his mouth and swallows them dry, then points to the next group of photographs. "Hit over the head with a hammer, then stabbed."
"What are you saying?"
Griffin asks slowly. "Two very specific ways of killing," Jess says. "Give me your phone." Griffin unlocks it and hands it over. He looks over Jess's shoulder as she enters words into the search engine. Then he stands up straight, looking from the board back to the phone, still in Jess's hand. Jess points to one of the groupings. "Where did these murders take place?" she asks.
"Both Leeds," Griffin starts. "Isabel Richards was round Hay Park."
"Yorkshire," Jess says. She looks at Griffin. "Both prostitutes." Griffin's mouth drops open.
"Sutcliffe,"
he says slowly.
"So this group,"
he starts, pointing to the first murders. "The Hillside Strangler," Jess replies. Griffin shakes his head.
"It must be coincidence,"
he says, almost to himself.
"And what about yesterday?" he asks. "That was completely different again."
Jess's face is grim. "A pregnant woman. 5 violent murders in a house."
"Fuck me,"
Griffin mutters. "Manson," Jess finishes for him. The revelation makes Griffin take a step back. His face is grey. He looks stunned, almost in shock.
"They're all MOs of different serial killers,"
Griffin says, articulating out loud what Jess is thinking. She nods slowly.
"The sick fucker is copying serial killers,"
she whispers.
The 23rd of August, 1990, 13:30 hours, A&E, Specialist Registrar, Dr. Evans. Trauma call, 4-year-old male, Robert Daniel Keane, date of birth, the 31st of March, 1986. History of presenting complaint. Father reports fall downstairs earlier today, approximately 14 steps onto tiled floor. No preceding symptoms. Reported brief loss of consciousness, vomit, x2, subjective confusion. Denies seizures. No post-ictal state. Subsequent deformity of right wrist. Ongoing pain of right lower limb. Previous medical history. Reported car accident at 36 months. No prior attendances. Drug history. Nil of note. Father unsure re-immunizations. No known drug allergies. Important. 1. Fall downstairs. 2. Possible traumatic brain injury. 3. Possible right distal radial fracture, 2 degrees, to fall on outstretched hand. 4. Query soft tissue injury of right lower limb. 5. Query non-accidental injury. Plan. 1. CT head in view of possible traumatic brain injury. 2. Observation in pediatric clinical decision unit until CT reported. 3. Plain X-ray right upper limb and right lower limb. 4. Discuss with Trust Child Protection lead given, possible non-accidental injury. 5. Refer to paediatrics. Specialist Registrar, 1500 hours, A&D. Specialist Registrar, Dr. Evans. Imaging update, CT report. Frontal extradural hematoma and overlying linear skull fracture. Right arm radiograph, non-displaced distal radius fracture. Right lower limb radiograph, no acute bony injury, evidence of previous tibial midshaft fracture. Discuss with pediatric consultant on call. Father attributes old fracture to car accident as toddler. Plan 1. Admit under pediatrics. 2. Ongoing observation for review, main. 3. Pediatrics to complete child protection pro forma.
Chapter 13. Today the crime scene is quieter. One lone officer guards the woods. Only a few figures in white remain. This time Carr is alone, Deakin declining to join her. She didn't argue. She knew why. As Kara drives up, she sees Libby waiting. Dressed in full white crime scene overalls, Libby Roberts smiles broadly at Kara as she climbs out of the car. Her hood is down and her long, bright pink hair shines incongruously against the trees. Known as one of the best in her field in blood pattern analysis, Kara was pleased to hear Libby was going to be assessing the crime scene. Getting her view firsthand was invaluable. Kara knew she'd make sense of the chaos. "Coffee?" she asks, and Kara hands her a tiny paper cup of espresso, exchanging it for the white suit in her other hand. Libby drinks as Kara puts the outfit on, discarding the empty cup back into Kara's car. Kara hates these suits. They never fit properly, the gloves are always sweaty, even in this cold, and the mask's constrictive, making her feel breathless and suffocated. But also because of what she's come to associate them with. The death, the blood, the horror of what's to come. They don their gloves, shoe covers and masks, pulling the hoods up. Kara follows her under the cordon. "Those poor girls," Libby mutters. They stand next to the car, and Libby points out dark brown patches on the grass. Blood, and apparent drag marks, what I'd expect to see from moving a body from the back seat to the boot. "Body?" Kara asks. "Just one?" Libby takes her around to the back. "Impossible to say for sure, but we've taken swabs throughout, so we'll be able to confirm whose blood is whose. However, if you're forcing me," she says, and Kara nods. "From the pattern, I'd say victim number one was killed in the back seat, then dragged around. Number two, in situ in the boot. See this pooling here and this void?" She points to a gap in the dark red stain. "That's where her body was lying. It's neat, with undisturbed edges, so I'm assuming she wasn't repositioned after the head was removed. And speaking of the decapitations..." Libby points to the two deep ridges in the bumper and the pool of blood on the ground. "My assumption is they were done here." She mimes a chopping motion with her arm. "One final strong strike on each, going straight through the vertebrae of the spine, into the car." "Any idea with what?" Kara asks, and Libby frowns. "Something like a meat cleaver? Find us a weapon and we can compare. Moving on," Libby continues. "We have some impact spatter on the top of the boot, indicating at least one contact into wet blood. See?" Kara grimaces. "This could have originated from repeated stabbing into an already injured area." They move around to the back seat, Kara following Libby without comment. It's a lot, almost too much for her to take in. "Same pooling, same spatter, but more of a mess as the victim tried to get away." She points to smears on the car window. Thick lines of red, smudges around the door handle. Kara can't help but imagine her last moments, desperately trying to escape. And the girl inside the boot, listening to her friend being murdered, knowing what must be coming for her. Libby points to another arc of dark red. "And this here," she says, "is suggestive of arterial blood, which I'm guessing would tie up with a perimortem wound on the victim's neck or similar. PM report back yet?" Kara shakes her head. "Today, I hope." Libby walks around to the other back door and opens it. She directs Kara's attention to a speckled pattern of blood on the back of the driver's seat, some drops dribbled downwards, some hollow and round. "This looks like expirated blood. See the air bubbles within the spots, and the stringing where it's mixed with saliva. I'd guess this is the victim coughing after being stabbed in the chest." Libby's eyes narrow. "Those poor girls," she repeats. She takes a deep breath in. "We have fingerprints in blood all around the car, some smudges, some patterns from material. From gloves? Could be. Let's hope that at some point he nicked himself on the knife and we get something from him." Kara looks at the position of the driver's seat. It's a big car, but there's little legroom behind. It's been pushed right back, the rearview mirror tilted up to a high angle. "What are your thoughts about that?" Kara asks, showing Libby. "We noticed it. Definitely not moved post-mortem. You see the linear pattern of drips." She moves out of the way so Kara can see. "Where the victim's blood has run down to the floor from the back of the seat?" Kara nods. "So could be our guy's natural driving position?" "Could be. We took a few measurements, estimated a height between 5'10 and 6'4. They walk away from the car. Outside the cordon, they pull their suits off, balling them up. Out of her usual crime scene outfit, Libby cuts an impressive figure in tight black jeans and a black jumper, thick eyeliner and long lashes highlighting her light blue eyes. She takes the white gloves off, revealing shiny, silver-painted nails. "You'll have my formal report within 48 hours, she finishes. Then she peers closely at Kara. "How are you doing?"
"I'm fine."
"Fine? You're the senior investigating officer for a violent double homicide, one of the worst I've seen for a while. And you're fine?" Kara shrugs. "You know. Still on for drinks tonight?"
"Of course. And Deeks? Is he coming?"
"No, he's busy." Kara grins. "Hoping for a repeat performance?"
"Would never hurt," Libby smiles in reply.
"He's not seeing anyone then?"
"Free and easy."
"I wouldn't go that far," Libby says, reaching over and giving Kara a hug goodbye. "Nothing about Noah is easy." Kara appreciates the quiet on the drive back, but any sanity she's managed to preserve is ruined the moment she steps in the building. D.S. Taylor is waiting for her at the door. Kara forces a smile.
"Griffin's been hanging around again," Taylor says, eschewing any sort of friendly greeting. "I thought you should know."
Kara beckons her over to the side of the corridor, out of earshot of other coppers. "What do you mean, hanging around?"
"Interviewing my arson suspect for a start," Taylor snaps. "Somehow got in there first, made me look like a right idiot."
"But you make it so easy," Kara thinks, but doesn't say out loud. She's worked with D.S. Taylor before. She's quick to make judgment, too quick in Kara's opinion, and the two of them have exchanged words more than once to that effect. But this isn't the time to make enemies.
"Did he do any harm to your investigation?" she says instead.
"No, but..."
Taylor scowls. Kara has the feeling there's something she's not telling her.
"This is my case, and we know who did it. We have forensics tying the wife to the murder weapon, plus a history of previous violence. Just keep Griffin away from me."
"Thank you for letting me know," Kara says sweetly. "If you could leave it here..."
"I've spoken to the DCS already," Taylor interrupts, then turns and walks off down the corridor.
"Shit," Kara mutters under her breath. She could do without Griffin making things complicated. Then a thought occurs to her. She goes into her office and clicks into the system. Sure enough, the timestamp of her last login reads 11:45 PM last night. She chews on a nail, staring at it. She should change her password, she knows, but at least this way she can keep an eye on what he's doing. She looks out to the incident room where the detectives are all working hard. They've spent the last 24 hours flat out,
knowing the golden hour of opportunity was closing. Deacon sticks his head around the door.
"How did it go with Libby?"
he asks.